Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Jenny, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Jacob.
Yeah. So where are you calling from today?
I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, right down the road from the University of North Carolina.
So what's the weather like over there right now? Because here it's like 80 in Minnesota.
Oh, gosh, we've had these big ups and downs, kind of. I think you have too. But normally this time of year, we're headed into the 70s and 80s. It's been a little more up and down than normal.
You literally hit the nail on the head with that hammer. I swear to God, because this whole week has been really nice. And here's my thing. It's like, I got a Ford Bronco. I've had it for a year now. So I'm just jumping at the bit to take the doors off, roof off. But later today and all of next week, it's going to be raining in the 40s and 50s. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. It's like 70-80 now. Oh, God. But so just right off the bat. So again, I am super happy for you to be on the show. You have so much great knowledge and experience, and I am just honored to have you on.
No, thank you. Very kind.
So right off the bat, I love asking this question. When did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
So my answer is probably going to be different than other guests that you've had, because I actually didn't know I wanted to be a doctor until I was almost in medical school. I was originally a musician, started college as a music major, and then became a French major and lived overseas. Oh, wow. And when I came back from that, I took a course that was called Biological Brain and Behavior, and I just kind of fell in love. So pretty much my whole career has circled around brain and behavior since that time, and I decided to do a PhD. First, so I was deciding to do a neuroscience PhD. And then I worked with some colleagues in a lab and they said, I think you should do an MD PhD. I think you'd be a really good clinician research scientist. I said, that sounds great. So, you know, you're young, you don't always know what you're getting into. And that's when I decided to do an MD PhD joint program. And I took a gap year to get all of my pre-med and MCATs done. So I took a little bit of a year because I was a little behind at that point with all the prerequisites.
Now, did you study? How do I ask this without being like, I don't know, weird about it, but was it easy for you to get into med school? Like, did you do relatively well in the MCATs the first time, or did you have to retake it maybe once?
The answer is I did do well on it, but I knew that I needed help to do well on it because I needed to get a very, very high score to get into these combined programs. So I took a prep class that was a pretty intense prep class just to get ready. So I had always been a pretty good student, but I knew that I really had to ramp it up a notch because it was so competitive. So I took a prep class and I took it very seriously. And I, you know, worked very hard at the actual test prep. So I did do well on the MCATs in large part, I believe, because of the prep I put in.
And another interesting thing, I actually heard music in itself, not necessarily makes you smarter, but it helps you with like studying because it activates a certain region in your brain.
Well, I'm a big fan of all things music. And one of the most interesting things about music and the brain is that I did my PhD in the neurophysiology of attention, and I focused on synchronous brain waves. So when our brains electrically oscillate at certain frequencies. So that's what I ended up focusing on. And music, as you know, is all about oscillating sound waves. And it's really interesting that the brain does synchronize to music. And even more interestingly, people's brains can synchronize when they are in sync with one another. So this whole field around oscillations and how brains use oscillations is fascinating. So I do think there's a huge overlap with music in general.
And there's particular waves, right? Are some of them called like the delta waves, alpha waves too?
Yeah, so a lot of people have seen kind of those pictures of the different types of waves, especially when you sleep, right? Most people have seen those pictures of the different stages of sleep and what they look like in your brain. But what's interesting about the brain is you can have different oscillatory patterns happening at the same time. So I could be in a theta wave state of brain, but I might have a specific little tiny area of my brain that's oscillating in a different way. So for example, my PhD, when you attend to stimuli, I showed that you have high gamma band activity during a very discrete chunk of time when you're paying attention to a stimulus. So it's not just whole brain activity, but all the time we have all these different oscillatory patterns happening in our brains, which is fascinating.
That's excellent. And is that also what motivated you to go into psychiatry?
So I did the combined degree. So I did the PhD in neuroscience. So like I said before, brain and behavior, I was obsessed. So I knew I wanted to do something with the brain. So my choices were really either psychiatry, neurology, or neurosurgery. Those were kind of the big three. And I actually love neurosurgery, but I didn't at that time want to be part of kind of the culture of surgery, which has its own kind of culture. And neurology culture is kind of a more formal, a little bit more of a buttoned up culture. And I really liked psychiatry because I felt like you got to talk a lot. You got to spend a lot of time with patients. And even if all of your medicines don't work, at least there's this idea of healing through talk therapy, which is what you do. And the idea that, okay, let's say nothing else works, I can still heal someone just through talking to them. I thought that was really interesting. And so I ended up deciding to go to psychiatry, although I really love neurology too. So it was actually kind of a hard choice for me because I really love both.
Do you ever get to work with neurologists though? At times?
Yeah, actually, one of the things I did in my clinical practice, when I owned a practice, I worked a lot with neurologists. So because I live here, UNC has a very good neurology program. Duke is right here, has a really good neurology program. So I did partner a lot with neurologists, and I did a little extra training in some neurological conditions like Parkinson's and Huntington's. And because the universities have specialized programs for those conditions, I would often partner with them.
Okay.
And I would treat a patient who was really struggling with the psychiatric manifestations of those illnesses. So I kind of found ways to stay engaged with neurologists, even though I chose the psychiatry path.
What kind of illnesses are you talking about?
So, you know, when we think about like Parkinson's, for example, which is pretty common, most people think about the motor part of Parkinson's, right? The gait and the tremor. But actually, Parkinson's has a strong psychiatric component, and sometimes it shows up first as a psychiatric problem and then later emerges the motor part. And similarly with Huntington's, there's a strong psychiatric component, but most people don't really think about that. And as a result, there aren't really a lot of psychiatrists who are trained to take care of the nuance of somebody with Parkinson's. And they're tricky because the medicines that treat Parkinson's are brain medicines, right? So if you're treating someone with psychiatric medications, there's this overlap and interaction. And so it actually can be kind of tricky to treat somebody with Parkinson's without making the Parkinson's motor symptoms worse.
Is there like a common mental health disorder that pops up someone early, like depression related symptoms, anxiety related symptoms? Since you said it's more of a psychiatry problem first.
Yeah. Often in Parkinson's, what shows up is kind of like an agitated depression almost, where you kind of get like this anxious, agitated state as a precursor to, and then, you know, there's some studies recently about other types of dementia, which I also love to work with dementia patients. About those starting, look, you know, as a depression, that sometimes they look like depression for a while before you actually see the profound cognitive change.
Okay. Again, I can imagine every patient being a little bit different, some worse or some better. Like, how, in your professional opinion, has the medication been when it comes to like helping these individuals? Like, do you think we have a long, long way to go still?
I think the medications, like you said, of course, it's always individual. Mm-hmm. I do think medications help a good number of people. Just generally speaking, psychiatric medications help people. But like, let's take depression, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, of people with major depressive disorder, you know, up to 30-40% may not respond to medicine at all. You know, even trying like 20 medicines, they still mm-hmm. might not respond. So we're starting to see more treatments with the electrochemistry of the brain. So I was mentioning like my PhD had to do more with electrical activity of the brain. Now we have things like transcranial magnetic stimulation becoming more commonly used. You like that one? Or maybe you've heard about vagal nerve stimulation that's just gotten approved for certain conditions.
It's sad. I don't know if it's like in North Carolina, but in the state of Minnesota, for you to even be approved, I guess insurance-wise, you need to have gone through like 20 antidepressant types of medication. Maybe I'm a little exaggerating, but it's a lot of antidepressants. And then you'd have to have failed mental health therapy or have had negative results in mental health therapy, only then to be eligible for TMS. And I'm like, these people can't wait that long. It's ridiculous.
I don't think it's quite that bad here, but you do have to fail trials of other treatment. And what's sad, there's a disconnect. So the American Psychiatric Association recognizes TMS as a first line treatment because it is so safe in terms of side effect profile. So there's a disconnect between what the experts say can be first line and what insurance payers can do. And that's part of why I've shifted gears and gone into healthcare systems and kind of the high level payer management, because I feel like right now that's actually where I'm having a bigger impact on the system and making it better.
Yeah, call me crazy. I don't know. Like, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. Like, first line, first care. Like, I think that's first. I mean, I don't know.
There's a disconnect. There's definitely a disconnect. And that's our healthcare system is, as you know, very fragmented and kind of, it's a broken system. But, you know, there are bright spots and there are people trying to fix it. And I'm an optimist, and there's definitely a lot in mental health changing right now. So I think in the next few years, there's actually going to be some pretty big shifts.
I hope so. I really do. I really do. And also, I don't know if you know this about me, I'm a huge fan of like other different types of therapeutic modalities. Like, I know here in Minnesota, we're trying to mix TMS with ketamine therapy.
Yeah. Yep. People, I know a lot of people doing that. Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And it's a great example. Ketamine was something that was being used a lot in the past many years ago. Right. But then it kind of spiraled and became, people were using it inappropriately. And then, you know, there's kind of this pendulum we have that it goes back and forth. So let's hope we get it right this time and we don't. Mm-hmm. We don't abuse it and we use it appropriately so that it doesn't swing back to, like, you know, being a treatment that we can't use.
And that's another thing that I don't think is covered by insurance. I think one way it is, and that's through the nasal spray that for depression.
Yes.
That's correct. It though. That is it.
Well, and so the reason for that, one of the reasons for that is because IV ketamine has been around for so long. There's no drug company that would take it through FDA trials because that's too long and expensive.
It's not expensive. Ketamine is one of the most cheapest drugs out there.
But to do the trials is expensive. To get FDA approval with indications is an expensive process. That's the disconnect. Okay.
like you need a lot of people, right? And I'm not a research expert, but I'm sure you need a lot of people, different types of research conducted through years and years, right? To maybe get approved by the FDA.
It's very long, very expensive. So it's easier for them to just use it, quote unquote, off label, rather mm-hmm. than go through the whole process. It's just too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've already talked about so many things about like the human brain and stress. And you being a psychiatrist, I'm sure when you started your career, you were new to it and you maybe went through a lot of stressful situations, especially with like client care, insurance and so forth, which really leads me into talking about your awesome new book, Work Smart, The Brain and Behavior. I would love to learn, again, what motivated you to, again, write this book and tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for bringing it up. So I, like I mentioned, did a PhD. So I'm used to academic writing, right? Which is kind of very formal and stiff. And I'm a big nerd, you know, a big book nerd since I was a little kid. I've always loved to read a lot. And so during the pandemic, like many people, I was trying to figure out the new way of working because I don't know about you, but I had always been in hospitals or offices and I did telehealth actually early on, but I was trying to figure it all out like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so I started researching when I just used brain and behavior as a way to help me understand how mm-hmm. to work better virtually or hybrid. And I kind of figured out some things that worked for me and I learned a lot. And then it was getting to be time to go, you know, kind of back to the office, quote unquote, you know, pandemic was getting better. This is about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And my friends and colleagues were saying, well, I don't know, I guess we'll just go back to doing what we were doing. And I got kind of passionate and kind of mad. And I said, well, why do you want to just go back to what you were doing? You used to complain about it all the time. You hated it and you found other things. And why do you want to just go back? I don't understand. Mm-hmm. You have an opportunity to be better. You know, work smarter, be better, like do something new. And that's when I got kind of passionate about it. So when somebody brought me the opportunity to write the book, I was like, yes, sure, I will learn to write a book. and it'll be, you know, it'll be a good experience for me. I'll learn how to write stories better. I'll learn what it's like to publish a book, which I had never done before. So it was a kind of an opportunity for me also to just learn. And the process was not exactly what I expected, but it's been a pretty amazing process. So the book came out about 2 months ago now, and I'm working on the audiobook currently. So that'll come out this summer.
Nice, nice. Especially people with ADHD like me would absolutely love that.
I have to say ADHD is probably one of my favorite things to work with. That was because my PhD was in attention and my practice was down the street from a university. I just did tons of ADHD and I learned to really, I don't personally have ADHD, but I've learned to love working with folks with ADHD. And I've worked with a ton of doctors and lawyers and CEOs and students and carpenters and just like a whole bunch of different people. Mm-hmm. And I really love working with ADHD actually.
It's funny though, like that you say that, and I love that there's doctors like you who are like that. I've ran into so many doctors who hate that disorder.
Yes.
And they hate prescribing for that disorder because to them, it could be very, very dangerous in so many different ways.
I think a lot of them are scared too, because they've never gotten training on ADHD. Like I didn't get any training on ADHD at
all. Not for psychiatry?
Really? I didn't get any, maybe like a 10-minute lecture somewhere, but I really had to learn it myself. Okay. Yeah. Most people don't know that. It's just,
wow.
It's just, there are very few psychiatrists who really have a lot of understanding and experience of it. And that's why part of the reason they're so anxious about it. And plus, you know, stimulants are the first line treatment and stimulants are just regulated and they're just a hassle. And the provider, the physician gets a lot of scrutiny if they prescribe those meds that they wouldn't get otherwise. And that can be very hard on a provider. Like I've had to go in front of a medical board because this was actually around buprenorphine, which you're probably familiar with as an addiction specialist back before mm-hmm. buprenorphine was more accepted. You know, 10 years ago, I was prescribing buprenorphine for people with opioid use disorder The level of scrutiny was very, very high. And, I had to have, you know, medical board come out to my practice, and the DEA would just show up at my practice.
Oh my
And
God.
there was this very high level of
Oh.
stigma and scrutiny for the physicians who prescribe these medicines. So it's kind of scary for a provider, you know? And so they shy away from it.
You might need to help me out a little bit. Okay. So was it used more as a harm reduction for opioid users, like a methadone or Suboxone?
I'm sorry. I was kind of confusing two things there. Yes. So the buprenorphine is for the opioid use disorder and the stimulants are for the ADHD. But as you may know, the overlap between the two is very high. So of folks with substance use disorders, up to 30% have ADHD. And of people with ADHD, especially adults who were not diagnosed in childhood, up to 30% of them have some kind of substance use. So there's a big, big overlap.
Yep. No, I just remember this one doctor telling me that it's just more concern, again, for the patient. And they use the term, though, good eggs and bad eggs. The good egg clients, well, the good egg clients use it, let's say if they're in college and they're actually using it the right way to study, where they say the bad eggs are the ones who abuse it, don't use it the right way, or sell it on the streets for money.
Well, that's diversion of, so any medicine that's diverted is illegal. So obviously that's a problem for everybody if you're doing illegal things with your medicine. But good egg, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't say good egg, bad egg.
Language,
I would just say that,
badly.
Yeah, I would just say that some people, you know, you have to be careful. That's all. There's just a higher level of scrutiny.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I don't want to go too long on this, but there's also a theory out there that there's no such thing as ADHD in a sense that common ADHD is actually caused by childhood trauma, which affects the brain as a child grows up for the prefrontal cortex and the trauma and the all the biological things that happen when you occur when trauma occurs to you.
I have not heard that all ADHD is caused by trauma. That's a new one
or,
for me.
I should say all, but like a good portion.
I would have to research that, but I mean, what I do know is that ADHD is very highly heritable, meaning that if you're genetically, one of your parents has ADHD, the odds of a child having ADHD is very high, even when they don't grow up together. So that to me would say it's not due to trauma, right? Because it actually has a genetic underpinning. So I'd have to research that. And I'm sure there could be cognitive deficits due to trauma. I definitely could see that.
The amygdala.
But the actual disorder, but the actual ADHD, you know, disorder as we know it now, I wouldn't say that's due to trauma. But they could overlap too. There's no reason you couldn't have had trauma and ADHD too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So when we were talking about, like, you know, your coworker going back to work, and correct me if I'm wrong, you kind of painted two pictures. It's like you can go back to work, but then think of a different mindset to make yourself happier at work. So you're just not like, oh my God, I have to go back to work, or maybe going on a new adventure, the new job.
Yeah. I mean, I say in the book, I say this in a snarky kind of way. I'm a Gen Xer. So I say, you know, do you want work to suck? Like, do you have 10 years of work ahead of you, 20 years? I don't know. Do you want it to suck? Like, why would you do that to yourself?
Yeah.
When there is a better way. And so my whole thing is like, let's look at what we were doing in the traditional office. I call it the traditional office. And let's challenge all the assumptions. And let's say what worked, what didn't, what do we want to continue? What don't we want to continue? And then let's just change it. Like, there's no reason. The future is here now. Like, there's no reason to just go back to the office without thinking about it. Like, obviously, for some people, that's the right thing to do, but not for everybody.
I was wondering, like, do you have like a strategy plan for some people where, let's say, their family counts on that job to pay the bill? So it's not easy for them just like, oh, I'm going to quit this job, wait a few weeks or month. Do you care telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And I wouldn't say this is something that happens overnight necessarily, but I think the first thing is, as an individual, knowing yourself is really important. So you're a therapist, right? Like, knowing yourself, what works best for me? Am I an introvert? Am I an extrovert? What are my strengths? What brings me energy? What makes me tired? What helps me, you know, because it is different for different people. And so that's the first step. Know yourself. Like, for example, I know myself, my brain is pretty terrible around 3 to 4 p.m. when my circadian rhythm goes down. If I schedule a meeting during 3 to 4 p.m., I'm kind of useless or irritable. And so I have to change my work schedule around that, just as a simple example. That's me. I know myself. Somebody else might be totally perfect at 3 p.m. or really excellent. So I think the first step is to know yourself. Then to look at where you're working and to see what is the work we're doing here. Who are the people that we have doing the work? And are we doing the work in the best way possible for the people that we have? And the answer might be yes, it's great for everybody and it sucks for me. In that case, I would say start exploring other opportunities that might work better for you as a human being. But what you probably will find, my guess, is that the workplace you're currently in isn't working for everybody. And so maybe there is an opportunity to say, hey, I don't know, is this really working for everybody? You know, like, for example, if everybody's commuting 2 hours to get into an office, hey, is it really working for all of us to commute 4 hours a day to get here? Is that really the best way to get the work done? And maybe it is, but maybe it's not, right? And maybe the answer is like, well, let's come in 2 days a week, or let's, you know, come in 1 week every 3 weeks together. Or, you know, I don't know what the answer is for each group, but there may be opportunities to shift the way your group is working to make it more successful for the majority of people. But if the group is working great and you personally are just not working great with that, that's when I would say start looking for some other opportunities where it's going to match up to you better. Because there are more opportunities out there now that are different than the traditional office.
You know, it's funny. I'm kind of dealing with a similar situation. Like, I find myself to be more of an introvert. And again, at a treatment center, I'm working with a group of people. And, you know, personalities don't always, like, get along. But again, I'm also starting the process of doing my own private practice. And again, I don't want to assume everything's going to be great if I'm just working alone. But I personally feel like, oh, I think I'm going to be so much happier not dealing with so many different personalities. And that actually kind of gets into my next question that might get into another question is, in your book, you kind of talk about like the three main aspects that affect mental health in a work environment.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, I was going to say, God, what if you just really dislike your coworkers? You're miserable every time you come into work. Oh, I got to deal with Susie's attitude or Ben's sloppiness. And
So the way I would break it down is there, you know, at the workplace, there are kind of three critical pieces. And if one of those pieces or more is not working well, you're not going to feel good at work.
Okay.
So the first piece is around time management. So if the group, not just you personally, but if the group is not doing a good job at time management, and you're bombarded with stimuli all the time, and you're supposed to be doing email all the time, and then patients are walking in, and then, you know, drama's happening, and then, oh, drop this, come talk. You know, if the time of the office, for example,
do you know where I work? Do you know my work environment? Oh my God, that's it.
So if the patients aren't respecting your time, or, you know, if that's not working, first of all, that's a key part. The second part is communication. If the communication in the office is not working, or at the clinic, you know, if you're unclear, you're talking past each other, you're not using the same language, you're not listening to each other, one person talks all the time and nobody else gets to talk. You know, if that is not working, it's going to feel bad. And then the final piece, which I think most people are struggling with right now, is empathy and connectedness. So even if time management's good and communication is good, if you feel a lack of empathy for each other and a lack of connectedness, it's still going to feel bad. So I think those are the three components that need to be functioning well for people to feel good at work.
I feel like I'm getting like triggered, but like in an educational way, because I can relate with empathy. And I always take responsibility for your actions or my actions. And I think any good person should. But yeah, the lack of empathy is just like, you don't care how the actions you take affect other people. you don't take time to consider how they may feel, which causes issues.
Right. And there's, you know, as a therapist, we learn about different kinds of empathy, right? And so there's the empathy that's cognitive, which is, I understand maybe what you're thinking. There's compassionate empathy, like, I want to help you. And then there's that emotional empathy, like, I feel your pain. And I find that what people don't think about with empathy is the compassionate empathy. Like, it's not enough just to know what the other person might be thinking or feeling. Like, you have to show with an action that you care. So in a clinic, for example, I find that having patients come on time and me being on time to see my patient is a huge sign of respect mm-hmm. and compassion. And if I need that to feel, I need that to feel good as a physician, and my patients need it to feel like I value them. So for me in my practice, that was a huge compassionate mm-hmm. empathy feature that I thought was critical. And if I didn't have that, I didn't feel good.
Okay, but yeah, absolutely. But I think there's a different aspect to coworkers, because you would consider them professional adults, but you feel like they act like children.
See, this is where we fall in a trap. All these professionals, we all think we're like, you know, oh, I'm a professional, so I'm not human. Mm-hmm. No, we all do the same dumb stuff. So, you know, a patient is a human being, a doctor is a human being, a therapist mm-hmm. is a human being, secretary is a human being. We all have the same dumb, stupid human stuff. It's just, how aware are we of our own dumb stuff, and how well do we translate that out to others? So I think I remember in my practice, I made the mistake of saying, oh, I'll just hire this doctor and they'll be a professional, like everything will be fine. Well, no, they're human. Like, I had to work with them as a human being, yeah. not just as a professional, right? And I do dumb stuff all the time. Like, I'm human too. I do dumb human things, like all of us. I get trapped on email sometimes, wanting to like click, 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 yeah. click, or, you know, I get distracted, or I'm not on time unless I'm really thoughtful about it. So we're all human at the end of the day.
I think there's two aspects to that, though. One, as society, as we view medical doctors in high power, high esteem, so they're very rarely challenged at all. They're a very strong medical board. But you also made an amazing point that they're humans. So you get one example of a patient trying to work with their, let's say, family physician, but the patient's actually disagreeing with the doctor. You know, no, this medication's not making me feel good, this or that. And the yeah. doctor could be like, no, you got to give it more time, this or that. I feel like that patient has to be like, no, I'm sorry, but I disagree, and I know my body. And then have the courage to maybe get a different physician.
And I would say a sign of a good physician or therapist or anybody that's professional, lawyer, or, you know, anybody, is if you have somebody that says, oh, well, it's okay to disagree with me. You know, I say that to my patients all the time. Like, mm-hmm. you can disagree with me. I'm just letting you know in my experience, and you know, this is what I recommend, but it's your body, it's your life. Like, if you disagree with me, that's okay. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's another option we can pursue together, and maybe there's not. Or I'll say, go, you know, I'd be happy for you to get a second opinion, you know, or patients bring me articles and I love that. And I'm like, great. Or like we were just mm-hmm. talking a minute ago about trauma need. I'm like, oh, I don't really know. Let me go look that up.
Yeah.
So I think a good sign of a professional is their ability to say, I don't have all the answers. I'm human. And then to be a partner with you, right? And it's mm-hmm. the same in other workspaces too. You really want someone to be curious and non-judgmental and say, you know, oh, I don't know. That's an interesting idea. I don't know. Let me go check that out. Mm-hmm. As opposed to like, you know, you're stupid, or just thinking in their mind, oh, you're stupid.
Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I have another thought too, like when we're like collaborating with other professionals, and let's say you feel slighted by another professional, it's so hard for the one professional that's been done wrong to yes. like be that bigger person and just like show kindness to that other professional, and then take the initiative to understand like, hey, are we good? Is there issues? Like, is there something we can like work on? And
so, oh, right. God. I had something recently where I had a patient. So I'm seeing a small number of people virtually, but I had somebody that really needed in person. Mm-hmm. And she was a tough, you know how it is sometimes, tough patients,
tough cookie.
Very demanding, really wanted a quick referral. And it's very hard to find an in-person psychiatrist at the drop of a hat. So I'm calling my friends and calling in favors and trying to help this young woman find somebody. And in my haste, I referred her to a provider that was not a good fit. Oh. And the provider reached out to me and said, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know, I spoke with your referral and, you know, it wasn't a good fit. And I just would like you to know in the future, like, this is the, I would prefer you to call me and let me know before you do this, because I would have avoided, you know, wasting the patient's time." And I was like, at first, you know, I'm human. I'm like, "Oh, ouch, that hurt a little bit. I messed up." But then after a couple minutes later, I was like, "Oh, you know, that was really big of her to just be very calm and reach out to me. And I really appreciated that." So like you said, you know, we all have to practice that. And yeah, it hurt a little bit at first for a minute, because I felt like, "Oh, I messed up. I don't want to mess up." But then I was like, "No, she, you know, that was right. And that was really good that she did that."
So she wanted like a little bit more time to like prepare, or?
She wants some more info. She just wanted a quick phone call with me to get some more information before talking with the patient. But in my haste, I just sent the patient right over to her.
And then did they meet and it wasn't just a good fit?
They did, I think, a phone call and realized it was going to be a bad fit. But she's like, "If you would have talked to me, I would have known that ahead of time."
Yeah.
So I can tell you, yes, this is good or not. And I didn't do that because I was rushing.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I didn't follow her process, they ended up having a phone call and it wasn't a good fit and it wasn't a good experience for the patient. So it was my error because I was hasty.
Again, different states, different like a number of professionals, but I know here in Minnesota, we are so low on psychiatrists. It takes months just to get one.
Same here. And that's why I was trying to help this woman and call, like I said, call in favors with my friends, basically like, please help her. And I felt like I was trying to go above and beyond for this young woman and get her appointment in person within a week, which, as you know, is very hard. And so I was feeling, I was in a tough spot, but that didn't mean I should have overlooked her process just because I was rushing. Right.
It's so almost like you felt the client's energy. You felt their energy and the urgency.
Yes.
And oh yeah. I'm so like that.
You know how that is.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah. The loving, helping nature. Just curious, do you get a lot of referrals from like family medicine doctors saying, "Hey, I don't feel comfortable prescribing this medication. We'll just say Adderall for one. Could you take this patient?"
I do. And it, right now I don't see patients from that scenario because as you know, the laws around controlled substances are up in the air and it's a little messy. So I'm virtual, so I'm currently not doing that, but I used to do that a lot. Mm-hmm. I prefer to do integrated care. I prefer to be doing consultation and helping primary care get more comfortable prescribing for things like ADHD or substance use disorders. Like that's my preference. And that's where I work with companies and try to consult with them to help them build that.
Actually, that's a great avenue. Would you tell my audience a little bit about your integrative care?
Sure. So just briefly, I have a history of working in integrated care going back like probably 12 years Medicaid here in North Carolina. And there's a model of care in particular called the collaborative care model, the impact model for psychiatry. I was very involved with that, getting that passed here in North Carolina. That was probably like 6 years ago now. But also a lot of other models of integrated care, like the primary care behavioral health model. So I got really involved with that in Medicaid here, working with primary care across the state here. And then nationally, I went on to take a national position with a company where I worked on integrated care at a more national level, doing it in what we call like a value-based care setting. So in a kind of a more complicated financial model where it's not just like visit money, like you actually are responsible for the quality of the output, which I think is super exciting. That's where a lot of medicine is going right now. And I'm very excited to be part of that. But yeah, integrated care is in my DNA and I do that kind of at different levels, but right now I'm doing it mostly with startup companies, newer mental health companies that are startups, but I do consult with bigger ones as well.
That's so cool. And Jenny, again, I had such a blast having you on the show. It was so much fun. I learned so much. I only wish we had more time. But one final question. What are your goals in the future? Let's say the next 5-10 years. Do you plan on starting a new project, a new book? What are your new ideas?
Well, I'll let you in on a secret. So I am writing book
Okay.
number two
Nice.
and maybe even number three at the same
Oh.
time. And I am thinking about some focus around mental health this time. So I'm just
Okay.
starting out, but working on that. And then what I like to do is have kind of a portfolio of work I do to keep it fresh. So I like to do some coaching with typically other physician leaders. I do a little bit of clinical practice, and I like to take on consulting projects that last, between like maybe 6 to 12 months. So I like to do a mix of things that seems to work well for me, keep it fresh. I don't burn out that way, and I feel like my impact is greater when I'm working with a variety of companies.
That's excellent. Excellent. Again, I learned so much from you, and I know my audience did. Now, if any of my audience members want to get a hold of you, how could they communicate with you?
Yeah, so the best way to get in touch with me is through LinkedIn. That's my social media channel. So it's Dr. Jenny Byrne, DrJenninieByrne. That's the best way. Just follow me and then you can ask to connect. I'll connect with you. I think that's how we got connected, Jacob.
I believe
So
so.
LinkedIn is a great place to find me. I do have a website if you want to like go and see different things I've written or videos. And that is also www.drjennybyrne.com, DrJenninieByrne.com. And if you want to find the book, it is currently on Amazon in ebook, paperback, and hardcover. And it is called Work Smart, Use Your Brain and Behavior to Master the Future of Work. So if you put my name and Work Smart in Amazon, it should pop right up. Or you can look at the QR on my LinkedIn page, it's also there.
Excellent. And for all my listeners, I will put those links in my show notes so it would all be one click away. Well,
Thank you,
again,
Jacob. I really appreciate this.
yeah.
I'm so happy to speak with a fellow behavioral health, mental health clinician, and hopefully your listeners get a little inspired and just keep up the good work you do. It's so important, and I can't thank you and your colleagues enough for doing that work because I know how hard it is.
Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it, and you as well.
Bye.
Hi. I just want to thank Jenny for being an awesome and amazing guest. I truly learned a lot from her, and I cannot wait to have her on again. And please, everyone, check out our new book, Work Smart, Use Your Brain and Behavior to Master the Future of Work, which is available on Amazon.com. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minnig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called ComiGo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.